Here we go. Stopwatch started. Isn't that nice? Why does he do that? Every week he starts his stopwatch. You'd think he would be smart enough to think about that before we start. I'm Phil Parr, and Deborah Kendrick is with us, and how are you?
I am just fine, thank you.
Well, first
glad
of all, where are you? What, and physically, where did you? Where is
I am in Cincinnati, Ohio, and people are often thinking that I'm in New York or some other place because of the writing that I do, but I'm right here in Cincinnati, Ohio.
I was going to say, a lot of folks are saying, Deborah Kendrick, I know her from somewhere. Well, where you know her from is things you have read that she has written. I was trying to think last night. I know you write for Access World.
Yes.
And I thought, did I see something by you from you in Dialogue or not?
Oh, yeah. For about 15 years, I wrote a regular column in Dialogue called Spotlight on Children.
Yeah.
That was about, it grew with my children. I think I started writing it when they were babies and quit around the time I got them off to college.
So,
something like that.
So they are off to college now. They're not.
My youngest, the older two are out, and my youngest just started college this year.
You know, everybody thinks, or not everybody, but a lot of people think Dialogue doesn't exist anymore. It does, and it's still a great resource for information about other blind people and what's going on in the blind community. I read it. It's now.
Yes, it is. I haven't written for it for probably 6-7 years, something like that. But I do still receive it, and I think it's unique. It is one of a kind.
It's a wonderful magazine. It's a little pricey. They've gotten the price up now, but they need to, you know, they need to earn a living too. Milk is not the same price as it was 5 years ago. Can't you remember that?
There you go.
Anyway, what? Tell us about your level of vision. Do you have any vision at all?
No, I like to tell people I'm the real McCoy. When you get me, you get the real deal. The only way I know if the light's on is if I can touch the light bulb.
Yeah. Or if you happen to know the position the switch should be in to turn the light on, then you would know. Other than that, touching the light bulb would be it. Has it been this way all your life? Were you born this way? What happened? How did you?
No, I had a rare childhood cancer called retinoblastoma when I was 5.
Yeah.
So I've been blind since then.
So you could see up until then?
Yeah, but apparently not much. Uh-huh. Because I unfortunately come from a family where there was never anyone to tell me stories remembering my childhood. But when my children, I got hold of some pictures of myself as a baby and preschooler and so forth some years ago. And my kids say that when you look at them, you can tell that I can see, but that it looks like I can't see very well. You know, you can see me looking at the camera.
Do you have a concept? I think the one of the differences is that I've come to realize since I started doing this. Do you have a concept of colors? Do you know what red is, blue is? Do you know that?
I do. Yeah, and I feel very fortunate that despite the fact I didn't have vision for very long, I think my foundation for color, visual concepts, orientation, all of that is a real blessing.
If you have a concept of colors, it's a blessing. People, you know, people describe things to me, and there's no you can't say, well, I don't understand that. I just go ahead and, that's red, and it looks like this. Well, hell, I don't have any idea what they're talking about. Yeah, they could just nothing. But you got that, and you are fortunate, even though you lost your eyesight, you are fortunate to have that color concept, because it's easier for you to understand what a sunset looks like, what the blue sky looks like, what the green grass looks like, where to me is nothing, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you were five, six years old, what decisions did they make concerning your early education?
Well, I was really lucky there, too, because I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and a resource classroom in a public school for blind children opened the year that I lost my sight, and my parents learned about it and took me there, and so I was in the first grade there, the second year that it existed.
Yeah.
And in that classroom, I learned Braille. And, you know, I don't know, whatever basic blindness things kids have to learn. And I think that my brain was wired in such a way that I was born to read. And since reading print was no longer an option, then I took to Braille very, very quickly.
Good.
And so by about the middle of the first grade, I think, I was down the hall with the sighted kids, you know, in the Bluebird group, which was the fast readers.
Oh, good.
But I was the only little Braille Bluebird. And, and you know, that resource classroom model, I think actually it was called the transitional model, was a great educational model for blind kids, I think, because we were different ages, different levels, and for a kid like me, that meant that I got to teach the other kids. You know, I got to teach other kids things, and, you know, it was great for my self-esteem, and it was great for other kids, you know, self-esteem and bonding and all that jazz. Kind of like my oldest child went to Montessori school for a while, and I thought, wow, this is very similar in principle to the kind of classroom I was in for 5 years, where all the kids help each other.
So you took to Braille very quickly. You learned to read Braille, and they had books for you to read.
Not very many.
We had a little...
We called it the library in the corner of the classroom. It was two little shelves, and because I was the one who loved the books more than anybody else, I got to be the class librarian, and so I checked the books out to everybody, and I bet I read every one of those books, I don't know, many, many times, because there weren't very many. And then when I was about 11, the class got crowded, you know, there were state requirements, they couldn't have more than 10 kids, and so I was the experimental kid that was sent to my neighborhood school. I was very angry because I felt like a bird kicked out of the nest.
Yeah.
And I loved my teacher, and I didn't want to leave her. But that turned out to be a good experience. But from then on, so really all of junior high and high school, I almost never had books because I was in a school system where they'd never had a blind kid and they just didn't know much about. So thank God I was a Braille reader because I took all my notes in Braille and kept that literacy level up. But the only Braille book I remember in high school was my junior year English literature book. And I can still see that book, many volumes.
We didn't have RFB&D then. We didn't have the Internet then, or we didn't have these easy transferring things into Braille like we can do now. Said none of that.
Yeah, it'd be great to be in school now, wouldn't it?
Well, my mantra is, if you have to be blind, it's a great time to be blind.
Absolutely.
All the wonderful things that we have, the computer, we've discussed this, is as important a step forward as was the invention of Braille for blind
people. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And it's certainly played an enormous part in my life. I mean, I would say if there were two things, external factors that have determined the course of my professional and personal life, it would probably be Braille and computers.
Well, but we survived those days when there weren't any books and when they really didn't much, absolutely much, really know what to do with a blind child. What, you know, they wanted us to be, to learn to make brooms or to do a vending stand or to, you know, being a lawyer or a writer was just out of the question. Anyway, you graduated high school from a quote normal public school.
Yeah, I did. And I didn't really know any blind people in those days, and I didn't like them. I thought I didn't like them. My parents, unfortunately, pretty much conditioned me that blind people were weird, and I wasn't one of them.
Lots of them are. And
yeah.
Yeah.
For all I know, I am. But
that's.
But. When I was ready to go to college, my family had no money, and a counselor at my high school learned about what in my state is called Bureau of Services for the Visually Impaired. It's the Voc Rehab System.
Yeah.
So we applied to them for money, and they said, we'll give you money for college if you go to this summer program for college-bound blind kids at the state school for the blind.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was horrified, but it turned out to be a wonderful experience.
They want to evaluate you and see what you're really made of.
Indeed.
And I guess you can't blame them for that if they're going to give you money, but then bureaucrats have to justify their existence some way.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Phil, what the other condition was. The other condition was, we'll give you money if you drop this ridiculous notion of wanting to be a writer. Because
yes.
A blind girl can't be a writer, said
That's
my
right.
counselor.
You can't do that. So you didn't take their money, or what did you do?
I took their money, and, you know, he wasn't very smart, because what I said to him, I guess I was kind of a manipulator. You know, I said, well, all right, then, what do you want me to be? And he said, well, I think teaching is a good goal.
Yeah.
And I did teach for a while, actually. But, you know, knowing what I know as an adult about teaching and writing made more sense. But anyway, so I said, okay, put that down. I'll be a teacher.
Right.
And, you know, that man, it never occurred to him that I never took any education courses while I was in college.
You went ahead and majored in English anyway.
I did indeed.
Yeah.
He never questioned it after that, so there you go. I like to say he made me a lot of money because I make my living both writing and speaking,
yeah.
And I use that story in a lot of presentations, so every time I do, I think, thank you.
Yeah,
but your story just got me another dollar.
He felt like he had done his job, and you got what you wanted, so everybody was
yeah.
happy. So you went to the summer camp. That you said that was turned out to be a good experience in that you got to meet some other blind people.
I did, and I met all of these wonderful kids who were my age, and many of them were similar to me, and many of them weren't, but I made some really good friends, a few of whom I didn't. We all stayed in touch during college, and then we all lost one another. And then,
yeah.
Oh, probably 15 years ago, a few of those people resurfaced, and I have continued the friendships where they left off. And it's just really been great. And in that experience, you mentioned evaluating me. Well, they evaluated me. And I knew all the stuff about how to be a teenage girl. They evaluated me out of hair and makeup and nails and clothes and typing, because I was a whiz typist. So what was left was cane travel, and I had had zero.
Well, and you needed that.
Oh, did I? I needed it desperately.
You did.
I had never... I'd never walked to school by myself. There was no reason I couldn't have. My high school was only three blocks away. But that was the area where I had really been shortchanged. So everybody else took all those classes. They had typing and daily living skills and all that stuff. And I had the English class that we all took that was taught by a university professor and cane travel. And free time in the middle to get in trouble.
And you met some weird blind people, yes, but you also met some blind people who had some of the same goals and some of the same problems you have. You had at that age.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was great. And saw some people who there were a few kids in the group who were very gifted guitar players.
Yeah.
And I, that summer is when I discovered folk music, and soon after the program, I got a guitar and started learning to play it. And I corresponded with one girl by tape, and she taught me some stuff, you know, via the mail on the guitar. And it wound up being a huge part of my college experience. I wanted to be the next Joan Baez, you know. I played guitar and sang in coffee houses and bars and stuff. And none of that would have happened if I hadn't met those blind kids that summer.
My favorite album of all time is Diamonds and Rust, by far.
It's definitely a good one. I don't know if it's my favorite. I think there's the one called Joan Baez 5. It's a much earlier album, and it's pretty perfect.
Well, I learned every song on Diamonds and Rust.
Oh yeah?
Oh yeah. That album just did. At that time, I had been just doing country, and I got exposed to Joan Baez and Jimmy Buffett at about the same time, and it changed my whole thinking about music. I was a sheltered hillbilly with Buck Owens on my mind. Anyway.
So you play guitar?
I do. I play guitar and sing. Made a living playing guitar and singing for many years.
Well, do you ever play on your show?
No, I don't. This is kind of different. I did one Blind Like Me show that featured Phil Parr music. I've got four CDs that have, I guess you would call commercial CDs. But anyway, that's another. And so we're going to have a good relationship. I'm going to teach you some audio, and we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
We're going to become friends. We may go see each other someday. Anyway,
I think so.
You started college as an English major at what college? In somewhere there in Ohio?
Adrian College in Adrian, Michigan.
Oh.
And I have to tell you what's really exciting for me. It's a little tiny liberal arts college, and my baby child, my youngest daughter, is a freshman there right now.
Is that right? That's
yeah.
Wonderful. Isn't that great?
It is. It just makes me so happy that first she didn't even want to visit there, and then somehow I talked her into it, and she fell in love with the campus, and it's just so cool that she's at my school.
Yeah. Yeah, that really is cool. And you did 4 years there? You did you were able to do it in 4 years to get your Bachelor of Arts degree?
Well, you know what? I always say there's only one thing I regret about my education, and that is, what was I in such a hurry for?
Yeah.
I had just had my 17th birthday when I graduated from high school, and I had just had my 20th birthday when I graduated from college. And I look back and I think, what was the rush? Those are some of the absolute best years of my life. Yeah. And I knew it when I got to that last semester in college. I panicked. I was like, I don't want to leave. This is my world. I don't want to leave here. So I did stretch it out one more semester with almost no classes, but enough classes for BSVI to keep giving me money.
Yeah.
So I was there for 3.5 years, but I was basically done. And then I took a year off, and it was really cool. I taught, again, I had no education courses, but I had a job created for me in the same classroom where I had been a child, and I was a teacher's assistant for a year, teaching little blind kids.
That had to be fun.
Awesome.
You know, I've often thought that I would like to do that. I'm a little old to be doing anything now, but I've often thought I would like to help blind children. I wish I had all these. The blind school I went to was a bunch of cranky old biddies that really didn't care about blind kids, but I wish I'd had someone like me that really cared about blind children and knew that their life could be good if they just worked at it.
Yeah. Did you go to the Texas school?
I went to the Texas school, and people complain because I complain about that school so much, but it was a horrible experience. It was just nasty. They didn't like me, and I didn't like them, and they didn't understand me. And I was going to do radio and music. I didn't give a damn what they wanted. I wasn't going to make brooms for a living. I knew that. I wasn't going to tune pianos for a living. I was going to do what I wanted to do, and it ended up working out. It might not have, but it did.
So
you got to teach blind children for a year, and then you went to graduate school, or did you?
I did. Yeah. Then I began applying for graduate assistantships, and I say there were a couple little milestones of discrimination along the way. My first experience with discrimination was the summer between junior and senior year of high school, when I applied for a job. They were looking for high school kids to work in the offices at the Board of Education, and I was a whiz typist. You know, I'd been typing, I don't know, 100 words a minute or whatever it was since I was 8.
Really?
And all my friends, you know, my telephone skills were legendary, because if we really wanted to find something out we shouldn't be finding out, I knew how to do it on the phone. So I thought, hey, this is made for me.
Yeah.
And I went over there, and the same principal that had gotten all kinds of mileage calling the press to come and write about his star blind kid said, basically, no blind kids need apply.
Yeah.
So that was my first kick in the stomach when it came to discrimination. And the next one was when I did finish college, I wrote 3 letters to TV stations with writing samples saying, hey, I could come and write commercials for you. I thought that'd be a cool thing to do. And one in the 4th letter to that school to be a teaching assistant. And one of the 3 stations basically offered me a job over the phone as a paid intern in the news department.
Uh-huh.
And I was high as could be, but then I went for the interview, which was originally just, just the kind of the final piece.
But they found out something about you they didn't know.
Indeed, they did, and it was the guide dog at my side that really put a little nail in the coffin, as they say. And, you know, I didn't know enough. I was too young to... I was just so humiliated because I didn't even get an interview. I got, how did you get here? Who wrote your letter? Who typed your letter? I did. Well, you couldn't possibly have done that. And so, anyway, that was the end of that. And then when I was ready to apply for graduate school, I'd gotten a little smarter. A year in the working world and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And so I was offered a graduate assistantship, a teaching assistantship at Kent State University. And I forget how it came up that I was blind after the offer had been made. But, boom, the offer was retracted.
Really?
And so I wrote this really impassioned letter. And basically said, you know, that any questions they had regarding my blindness, I would happily address. And if they thought I was capable before I was knowing I was blind, then I was still capable. And it was, to their credit, everything got straightened out. I didn't have to go down there and throw a fit or anything.
Which you were ready to do if you had to.
I was. I'd grown a lot in that year. And they were wonderful and welcoming and accommodating and all that. And they had, I think they did this for all teaching assistants, but they had a PhD student, you know, kind of do some scouting for apartments and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I do remember that this guy, we would talk back and forth on the phone about what I wanted and that sort of thing. And he found what he thought was a perfect apartment. And when he told them I didn't have a guy, that I had a guide dog, they didn't want me. And I did at the time. My attitude was, then I don't want them either. And he wanted to fight it. This guy who had never met me,
yeah.
He was, you know, on a quest. And I said, nope, I don't want to live there. I'm not sure, Phil. I mean, my whole adult life has been focused around advocacy issues, but I'm not sure I would do that any differently today. I don't, you know, if somebody is so ignorant that they don't want my guide dog.
Of course, now they couldn't refuse you, could they? Legally?
No, they could not.
You can say what you want to, but that's a great step forward. They couldn't refuse you.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I consider great. I mean, I think that's wonderful because they can't, because there's no reason. No reason other than they just didn't want to fool with you. They didn't want to,
Yeah. But, you know, on the other hand, So I got an apartment in this apartment complex that was really conveniently located. You know, it was just across the street from campus, and I could get to all my classes on foot and all that jazz. And after I'd been in school for about 6 months, you know, with the teaching assistantship, you get free tuition and a small stipend. And then in exchange for that, you have to teach.
And you get course credits also?
Yeah, your tuition is free and you get all your credits.
Oh yeah.
But then in exchange for that you have to teach a freshman English class.
So what?
Or different kinds of things. Now one quarter my job was really a cakewalk. I was in the can't remember what it was called, but it was like a little library room, and I just had to sign people in and sign people out. That was great. But I only had that one quarter. All the other quarters I had to teach. And then you get free tuition, and then you get this stipend, but the stipend isn't much. And so after, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, maybe 6, in an apartment by myself, I had to find a roommate because I was poor.
Yeah. Enough eating pork and beans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that organic peanut butter from the food co-op that you got half price because you work there bagging the groceries or something.
Yeah.
And I met this other girl who played guitar, and we were going to room together. And, you know, about 3 weeks before we moved in together, she said, by the way, I don't know if I told you this, but I have to bring somebody else into the apartment because I'm a personal care assistant to a girl in a wheelchair, and she has to come too. And this was such a learning experience for me, Phil, because
yeah.
I feel like that was when the light went on, not then, later, in retrospect. That was when I understood how people can be so stupid about us, because I was stupid about a wheelchair. I was freaked out. I was like, oh, wheelchair, what are we going to do with that? What are we going to do with her? And Sue and I became the very, very best of friends, and we're still in touch, you know, more or less at Christmas time these days. But I absolutely adore this woman. And she knows that the first 4 weeks we lived together, I had nightmares about her in a wheelchair every night. Every night I had this recurring dream that we were going over to campus. There was a steep hill behind the apartment building, and I would be pushing her chair up the hill, and I would lose control, and it would go flying, and it was all my fault, and she was going to be hurt, and it was just this. And I know from that, you know, that was my sort of peek into how people are stupid about us. Because, of course, then, you know, I got to know her and be her friend, and who cares, you know?
Now, let me get absolutely straight on this. Not only was the girl you had invited to live with you coming, but there was another girl coming also.
Yeah, she was bringing... There were three of us. She was bringing... She was a PCA to this girl who was quadriplegic.
Uh-huh.
And she neglected to tell me the whole while we were making plans.
That's amazing.
that she was bringing this other girl.
Because she thought you would do exactly what you did.
Yeah.
Which is freak.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
But probably.
But think of the... Now you know what a wonderful learning experience that was. Because you learned about another handicap. She learned about you. And it was had to be. And then you could afford to eat. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, a lot of my writing career has been writing for a lot of mainstream magazines and newspapers. And one of my favorite articles that I did was after Sue started having children, I did a big feature article on her and her family for Parenting magazine. And because, you know, she's a quad. So, you know, people wonder how blind people have kids. Well, that's nothing compared
to
how does a quadriplegic hold her baby, for Pete's sake, you know, or feed them or pick them up, whatever. And they worked out so many cool adaptations. She and her husband was, you know, fully able-bodied. And anyway, she was just an absolute wonderful parent, and it was just a lot of fun. Anyway, it's the only time a magazine has ever paid my expenses for me to go visit a friend for a week.
Really? We need more of that, don't we? Were you, speaking of that, were you during high school or during your college, were you dating any or not?
Was I what?
Dating? Yes.
Yes. As a matter of fact, quite a lot. And I can't, you know, the one thing that my teenage experience does not match, you know, of course, today I have lots and lots of friends who are blind, and lots of us have memories that are similar and similar experiences and all that, and you know that. I mean, there's lots of things we've all shared, whether we were together or not.
Oh, yeah.
But the one experience that is different for me from most of the people I've met who attended public school is that those were some of the best years of my life. I mean, I was extremely popular. I had lots of dates. I, you know, went to all the right parties. I was on student council and in the honor society and, you know, in a bunch of goofy clubs. And, you know, I loved high school, just absolutely loved it. And I have tried and tried to figure out why I was so fortunate. And I don't know the answer, but I do know one other thing that was different about me, and that is I didn't have any mobility skills. And sometimes, I've told parents this of blind kids, sometimes I think not having mobility skills was a plus, because what I would do first day of school, I'd get to my first class with somebody's help, and I'd sit there and I'd listen, usually I admit, for, you know, the cute boys. And then I'd get up at the end of class, go over to where I heard that boy and say, excuse me, but my next class is in room 312. Can you help me find it? And I made a lot of friends that way.
I love it.
I spread myself around, you know.
You may be onto something there, because you're the first blind person that went to high school. Well, no, maybe not the first. There have been others, but most blind people who go to public school hated it. I mean, just weren't... Yeah, and so you may be on to something here inadvertently, because boy, guys like to help a helpless female. I still do.
You know what else is very embarrassing? I can't believe I'm telling you this is going to be on the air.
Oh, it's great. It's okay.
I didn't know any sighted guide techniques. You know, I didn't know any of that. So I held hands with people. Anybody who guided me, boy, girl, teacher, I held their hand. I didn't know that wasn't appropriate.
Why isn't it appropriate? It's okay. It worked for you.
It did. Yeah. And there was this one teacher. He was a student teacher who was a big, you know, football player for the University of Toledo, and all the girls had crushes on him. And his subject was algebra. Ah. And I had trouble with advanced algebra because I was in this school where they had no blindness skills, and they didn't know how to teach me. I did it all in my head. And when you get to advanced algebra, you know, these equations take up pages. I couldn't hold that much in my head. So they said, well, she needs tutoring. So the student teacher had to tutor me. And I was so full of myself. We'd sit out there in the lobby every day, and all the girls would tell me how jealous they were. And then he'd, you know, he'd guide me to my next class.
He'd grab your little hand and guide you to your next.
Yeah.
Deborah. Good. So, that's good. You know.
Well, you know, there's a part of me, you know, when I see these little kids with, you know, blossoming O&M skills, I think, oh, shame on me. I was a real loser in that department.
But there could be high school girl out there thinking, I think I'll try that. You know, I don't have to be so damn independent. Maybe I'll ask for a little. You know, they always said that an old boy that goes to church, a man who goes to church by himself with a small child, is going to get hit on hundreds of times. Because, you know, and so there may be something to not admitting that you can, you know, because most of the kids that go to high school, I can get to the next class. I don't need your help. When, you know, maybe that's such a wonderful story. I just love it. So high school and college were good. You played guitar. Everybody loves a guitar player and a singer, Joan Baez Jr.
I wish.
So this had to be sometime in the 60s, in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah, you nailed me.
We've got you, don't we? We've got you, don't we?
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s, that was me. Yeah.
All right, so we got you through graduate school, and you graduated with a degree in?
English literature.
In English literature, and the guy didn't even know it.
Yeah.
How did you wanted to be a writer? How did you think you could do that? How did you imagine you could accomplish that?
Well, I did not have a clue because when you're in college and you're studying English literature, you study all this classical, highbrow, intellectual stuff, and that was what I knew. Fiction and poetry. And so I guess I thought I was going to be the next great American novelist. But of course, you can't make a living being, you don't just go get a job as a novelist. And so the first couple years out of graduate school, coincidences have often found me so that
okay.
I remember when I was about 30, I did a resume and showed it to a friend of mine who was a professional headhunter, and he said, you know, you've got to take some of this stuff off here, because if I didn't know you and I read this, I would think either this woman is 80 years old or that you were a liar, because there's so much on here. And that is simply because coincidences have happened to me a lot, so that I've done a lot of different things. So, for example, when I was in graduate school, there was this pilot summer program where students got jobs teaching in this program for learning disabled kids, little kids. So I did that. And then, you know, I'd already done that in between year with blind kids. And then there was a mom who wanted to keep her little blind kid in the rural school that was near Kent, and no teacher to be found, and word of mouth found me. And so I was this little first grader's program. That was my first year out of graduate school. I was her program, and it was a half-time job. And then there was this guy who was in his early 20s, and because he had grown up black and blind and in Alabama, or was it Mississippi, one of those states, and poor, nobody ever sent him to school. And he and his grandmother had moved to Ohio at some point, and he heard a PSA about voc rehab, blindness services, to the tune of Everybody Deserves an Education.
Yeah, yeah.
And he called the number, and I wound up being his program. And it was really cool. I taught this man to read Braille and then got all the GED materials and taught him all of his subjects except math. Another teacher did math. So I, you know, got him all the basics through, you know, reading and social studies and all that jazz. And he took his GED, and he wound up getting a college degree after I was long gone. Yeah.
That's so nice.
And then my husband, I got married in there, and my husband had followed me to Kent, and he was offered a job in Cincinnati. So I thought it was my turn to follow him, and I did. And I first looked for teaching jobs, and I wound up volunteering at the Clover Nook, what's now the Clover Nook Center for the Blind, attached to the Clover Nook Printing House. And I was volunteering there until I found a real job. And a woman who was a teacher had a medical crisis and suddenly quit, and by then, everybody knew me. I'd been hanging around for 3 or 4 months. My volunteer job was I invented a newsletter for them.
Okay.
So I was getting to know all the students and all the teachers and interviewing everybody and stuff. And lo and behold, this woman had a medical crisis, and they had an emergency with no teacher. And this somebody said, let's hire Deborah.
How about Deborah? Yeah. Yeah.
So, now, they couldn't do that today either, Phil. There is no way a center like that would hire someone without a master's degree in rehab. There's no way.
Well, besides that, nowadays they'd have to post the job for 20 days or whatever they require you. You know, you couldn't do that nowadays.
Yeah. So I did that, and then I did that job. I don't know, it was about a year and a half. So all these things were short, but I did that for about a year and a half. And loved it, by the way. And we had a teenage program in there, too, in the summer that was like the one I'd been in. And, oh, I loved those kids.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, then I had my first baby. I worked right up until the day before my first baby was born. And I said, I'm coming back, you know, when she's 6 weeks old or whatever. And then, I wasn't going back anywhere after I got to know her.
Yeah.
That was not a possibility. So I had to figure out, I mean, we had depended on two incomes. We needed two incomes.
Yeah.
I had to figure out a way to make money and still be with my baby. So I started tutoring, and I tutored mostly blind kids.
In your home?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And people brought their little kids to me. And then I just loved being a mom so much, and I loved figuring things out, like, you know, I wanted her to be dressed really, you know, how was I going to keep the blue socks with the blue dress and, you know, all that junk.
Yeah.
So I was always figuring all this stuff out. And the pediatrician kept saying to me, you should write about this stuff. And so I wrote an article, Dialogue Magazine. It has a lot to do with my actually becoming a full-time, full-fledged writer, because I sent an article to them, and they bought it. And then the editor, who was Louise Kimbrough at the time, tracked me down and said, as talented as you are, I'm sure you write for all the slick magazines, we called them back in those days, you know, the the big glossy page magazines.
Uh-huh.
She said, I'm sure you write for all of them all the time, but if you have any time to spare articles for us, well, here, I'd only published one article in my life, and it was for her.
And she thought, but she thought you were making a living writing for big magazines.
Yeah, she thought I was, like, really, you know, some kind of real pro already. So that gave me the courage to try to do just that. And I've met so many writers who tell the story of when they were starting and they got rejection after rejection after rejection. And it's a very lucky thing for me that that didn't happen in my beginning, because I would have quit. I know that about myself. I don't take rejection well. So it's really wonderful that all my first forays were successful. You know, people people bought my articles. And now, except for Louise, nobody knew I was blind. I sold all these articles through the mail, over the phone. Nobody knew I was blind. So that was another real turning point when I came out, so to speak.
Why would they need to know you're blind? They don't need to know that. That's, you know, sometimes they're better
That's
off not knowing.
That's kind of what I thought, yeah.
Sometimes they're better. So you have actually been able to make a living as a writer.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes some years better than others, but...
Well, yeah. But you haven't had to pick up that guitar and go on a bar job in a long time. No.
I wouldn't even contemplate it. I haven't picked up the guitar in so long that I'm not even sure I still know how to play. Every once in a while, it's probably been a year or so now, I'll look at it and there's nobody around. I'll think, get out just to make sure I still know how to form chords.
You need to do that.
And I do, and it feels so good, and I think, oh, I got to do more of this, but I don't.
Now, you say writing for the glossy magazines, as we call them, or as you might have called them back then. Like, who have you, what magazines have you written for? People? Life? Time?
There was a time, let's see, when I did a lot of writing for Parenting Magazine, sold articles to Woman's Day, some regionals that are big, Ohio Magazine. Isn't this weird? My brain is blanking. Executive Lifestyles. Anyway, there are others. But what happened along in there that also was a big turning point was when I did have a breakthrough where I came out, so to speak, a friend of mine who was a nun asked me to write for this little Catholic newspaper an article about this thing back in the mid-80s that the churches did that they called Access Sunday. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do that because, you know, I'm just starting
What was Access Sunday? I can kind of guess, but...
It was like, let's bring out all the Blinks and Crips and bring them to church for a day. So I kept saying, no, I don't want to do that because...
They shouldn't be doing that, and I don't want any part of it.
Yeah, and my career was just really getting underway. And, you know, I was really... established, and I didn't want to blow my cover. But she begged and she pleaded, and so I gave in. And what I did is I went around and interviewed people about this whole thing, and they all said what I felt. So I wrote what was going to be my first disability rights editorial. That basically what I just, you know, that we don't want to. None of us want a day like that. We just want a place at the table all year round.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy, oh boy, it really stirred a lot of stuff up. People in my own church got really mad at me. And lots of people, you know, just really liked the article. And the most important thing was that it gave me a taste of how delicious it was to write about all this attitude stuff.
Right.
That I live with and that you live with.
Yes.
And I wound up, well, there was a Sunday magazine in our newspaper in those days, like a lot of them used to have and not many do anymore.
Yeah.
But we had this really nice Sunday magazine, and I had gotten a lot of assignments with them. And I was also doing a lot of volunteer work, and because of the volunteer work, some people nominated me for this thing that the Cincinnati Enquirer, which is the big daily paper, it does every year here. They choose 10 women in the community to be Women of the Year. And I'll tell you, I think I was the youngest woman they ever named because they're usually really pretty old. But anyway, I was one of the Women of the Year, and this disability column idea had been percolating in my brain.
Okay.
And the Women of the Year thing was pretty cool. I mean, you know, there were articles about me in the newspaper, of course, and then they had this big fancy schmancy luncheon, and, you know, it was great. And but the best part was when you got your award, you got given this little gift, and the publisher of the paper shook your hand. So I went home thinking, if I'm ever going to pitch that column, I should pitch it while that publisher knows my name.
While that guy remembers your hand and who you are. Yes.
Exactly.
So you did.
So I did. And this is the thing we all hear all the time about networking. And I'll tell you, I fail to do it so much because I'm a procrastinator. But for once, I did it. I made myself do it. I wrote a proposal that I wanted to launch this column and all the reasons why it was a good idea. And do you know, he wrote me a handwritten note that I got 4 days after I sent mine. And it said, Deborah, this is a wonderful idea, and no one better to write it than you. I will tell our features editor to call you. And so it happened, and I launched a weekly column in 1986 that wound up being in a lot of papers various years.
This was picked up. This was on AP and picked up by other papers?
Yeah, well, it worked different ways, different years. It was syndicated by King Features for a while, and they sold it to papers. And then sometimes a person with more marketing initiative could have just sold it to lots of papers on their own. I mean, that's what other freelance writer friends of mine do. But I'm not a marketer. I'm a writer. So sometimes I would do that. If I would write, if I would write something that had a real tie-in to San Francisco, then I would send a message to an editor at the San Francisco Chronicle and say, you might be interested in this. So in that way, you know, various columns were bought by various papers.
It'd be nice to have an agent, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I've thought that for a long time. But at this point, it's something that, you know, newspapers are getting smaller, and I'm still doing a column. The only paper it runs regularly in now is the Columbus Dispatch. And, you know, some weeks I think, I don't want to do this anymore. I mean, because I love writing, and I love writing about disability rights and getting my opinion out there, but doing a weekly column is so much harder than people would think. It takes up so much of your time, whereas when I do features for Access World, for example, I can stick with that, you know?
Yeah.
I can really focus on it and get more detailed and spread out. You get more room, you know.
is the Columbus Dispatch one of the newspapers that is read to us by that, what do they call it, that you can call, the NFB has set up that you can call it?
Yeah.
So I could go to the Columbus Dispatch and maybe find something that you had written.
You could indeed on Sundays. It always runs on Sunday. Although I just sent my editor, and I haven't had an answer yet, so I don't know the answer, but I was at the CSUN conference last week, and Ray Kurzweil gave such a cool speech that I wrote about it, and I sent it to my editor this morning, and I said, will you consider running a column during the week? Because I think if you wait till Sunday, this is old. But
okay.
So we'll see. But, yeah, it's on Sundays, and when you do it on Newsline, it's in the section called Editorials.
It's Editorials, and it's in your byline, Deborah Kendrick.
Uh-huh.
Deborah,
yeah.
We've killed an hour. Doesn't seem like it, does it?
You know why? Because blah, 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 blah.
Because I got you. Because I did exactly what I intended to do. I got you talking. And,
you did.
You know, the only way to do an interview is get somebody to talk. Those people who want to do interviews and then to give you monosyllabic answers, that's no fun. You're a talker, and I need talkers to do these interviews. I think we could probably do another hour if we. Do you have a website?
I don't yet. I'm actually working on that right now, and I hope I will have soon.
Do you have an email address you'd be willing to give in case there is anyone who wants to get in touch with you about a writing career or about anything?
Absolutely. I'll give you my one at Access World because it's easier to remember.
Yes.
It's DKK, D as in Deborah, DKK at AFB, American Foundation for the Blind, .net.
DKK at AFB dot net.
Exactly.
Doesn't get any easier than that. All right. We're out of time. If you hold on a minute, I need to talk to you.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
Well, it just don't get no better than that, does it? Songwriters do it. Deborah Kendrick. I've read many, many things she's written in Access World and many years ago in Dialogue Magazine, and you can get a hold of her if you like at her AFB address, American Foundation of Blind, DKK at AFB.org. I believe that's it, yeah. All righty, back to the business at hand. If you have not been contacted, and I should have contacted you, I know, but maybe I haven't. Anyway, Blind Handyman and Blind Like Me need guests every week, and we'd like for you to come and be a guest. A lot of folks say it's even fun to do it. Hear yourself back on the radio, internet radio. Or you can contact me, Phil Parr, all one word, P-H-I-L-P-A-R-R, at consolidated.net. Almost forgot there. Phil Parr, all one word, at consolidated, C-O-N-S-O-L-I-D-A-T-E-D, consolidated.net. Phil Parr at consolidated.net. If you want to call, you can. It's 936-634-9500. Sometimes I think about, I don't want to do this anymore. Until I do an interview like that one. And then I want to do all interviews like that, because those kinds of people are easy to talk to. They tell their life story very well and are proud of it, and should be. Yeah, you do interviews like that, you want to keep doing it. Anyway, thanks for listening. We hope you'll come back next week and tell your friends about it, and we hope you'll come be a guest on the show. Phil Parr at consolidated.net. Write me, all right? See you next week. Bye-bye.